Hello, this is Christopher Holmes, and this is Zero Point Radio Show. I'm a psychologist, a forensic and clinical psychologist, and a scientist. I'm interested in the sciences, physics, medicine, creation science, and I'm a mystic, and I'm interested in the multidimensional nature of human existence. And in this series of biweekly shows, I articulate what I now call zero-point teaching. This teaching is not simply based on my own experience and work, but also on my 30 years of investigation of mystical and esoteric teachings and science. And it's synthesized in this zero-point teaching. My website's at www.zeropoint.ca, and up there you'll find a wide variety of my writings and chapters from my various books. You'll read some of my recently, I posted two letters I wrote on Kabbalah, and they were written to Contact Music about Guy Ritchie and Madonna and their studies of Kabbalah and the significance of Kabbalah as a teaching. And I've just posted a review of the recent DVD, The Secret, and the critique of that, which I'm going to share with you in a few minutes, as well as a critique of Dr. Chopra's book, How to Know God. I've posted that and the critique of What the Bleep Do We Know, to which I respond that they knew very little. In a way, I'm highly critical of a lot of New Age thinking and understanding, and I'm also highly critical of the mainstream dogmas of modern science and pseudo-psychology. And what's explained in this radio show and through my teaching is a whole alternative model of human existence and what we really are as beings. It's not easy to understand what I teach and understand, but if you listen and over time learn the language, and you can understand more and more of this teaching. I hope we have some new guests today. As last Tuesday, I was on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie for 2 hours, and that was a fun show. It talked about different aspects of my work than I usually talk of. And had my web statistics. I usually get about 200 people a day to my website, and during those periods I got about 17,000 just in those few days of being on Coast to Coast. So I'm about 20,000 visitors a day to my website this month. To me, that's really rewarding, as I know there are all kinds of people beginning to go to the site and read some of the materials I have there. And to think that, oh, wow, that's cool. 1,000 people a day went and read some of what I'm writing about. Wow, that's cool. Mystical science, yeah. So it's highly diverse materials up there, and I'm continuing to work actively on it. I'd like to thank some new friends out there, I think, may be listening today, people especially who emailed me and shared some of their responses to my Coast to Coast interviews. And some of those letters I've posted up on my website to share them with anyone who is interested. Also, a few people sent me some really very nice books. Yesterday, a package on Maya Baba, including kind of a classic work on Baba called The Wayfarers, a book on Gopi Krishna, What is Cosmic Consciousness, a book entitled The Child Within Lives On. So a series of esoteric and mystical books that people sent to me, and I'm going to take my time and try to review each of those over time on my site. So I do encourage people to go to Zero Point and try to understand. It needs a certain effort on the person's part to understand the teachings being elaborated here. First and foremost, in a way, is the idea that a human being has an I. What I'm going to do today is, in this first half, I'm going to talk and give a talk for about another 20 minutes by myself, and then invite a guest in. And in the last part of the show, I'm going to open it up to calls. So at the moment, though, I'm going to share my review of this movie, The Secret. But before I review the movie, The Secret, I'm going to tell you what, from my perspective, is the secret. Okay, not that in your hearing what I say is the secret means that you'll really understand what it signifies. So you might acquire it as an intellectual idea and think you then understand it, but that's not really understanding it. You have to grasp it on a deeper level to really understand what it means. So I'm going to begin. I'm going to tell you a secret, and then I'm going to review the popular movie, The Secret. I thought I'd focus on The Secret today because I seem to get most responses from people around my critique of The Secret on Coast to Coast. A lot of people saying, oh yeah, they didn't like a certain aspect of the of that program and movie. It's materialism, and I'll come to that. But I'm going to tell you a secret first. And I say my secret's more of a secret than their secret. Not that neither one would be competitive in that way. But I just think there's something quite fanciful in what that movie portrays. And I think we, as human beings in our life, we need to understand the secret of spiritual psychology. And I'm going to tell you a secret of spiritual psychology. And that's a real secret. This is a real secret. I'll tell you it. And I'll do it simply. Today I'll draw from the Bhagavad Gita and read some quotes from the Gita, which is articulated by Lord Krishna, who's in interaction with Arjuna on a battlefield. And there's a huge war about to occur. And you have armies representing righteousness and the more noble side, and then you have the forces of barbarians on the other side, the kind of forces of greed and who have the forces of destructiveness. And there's this great battle about to occur, and Krishna's on the battlefield. And Arjuna is a spiritual warrior, and he's a charioteer, and they're going into battle. And Arjuna kind of doesn't want to go into battle, and he foresees all the death and destruction that's going to happen, and he kind of has no heart for it, has no stomach for it, and he kind of at one point I think throws down his arrow and says, I'll just be killed. I can't go in and participate in all this slaughter. And Lord Krishna then says to Arjuna that the wise lament that neither the living nor the dead. And by that he means that the wise know that there's something eternal within a human being that persists beyond death. So in a way, the wise don't lament death so much because they realize that the true essence of the person, the spiritual soul, doesn't die with the material body. That there's some kind of spiritual soul that indeed inhabited the body. It was like the living entity within the body. But when the body dies, the living entity doesn't die. It just withdraws from the body. But it has persistent existence in afterlife planes and in other lifetimes, that you might be embodied again in other bodies, other lifetimes. So then, in the Gita then, see, Lord Krishna tries to instruct Arjuna as to the science of the soul, explaining the nature of self according to this classic book of Vedantic or yogic literature, the Bhagavad Gita. It's an elaboration of the science of the soul. So I'm coming to my secret. If I can just find my... here are these four quotes from the Bhagavad Gita, all embody the same secret. I am that Lord, represented as the super soul, dwelling in the heart of every embodied being. So this is a statement that the Lord of the universe, the kind of higher dimensional principle, the super soul principle, dwells in the heart of every embodied being. Okay. Second quote. Out of compassion for them, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Okay, so this suggests that this I within the heart somehow is connected with light and illumination and knowledge. And the light of the heart and the knowledge of the heart can illuminate the darkness born of ignorance. See, from an Eastern perspective, a person mistakenly thinks that their self and ego or mind is simply in the head, in the brain. I call that the head doctrine. Whereas this teaching is saying that no, I is associated with, dwells in the heart, and it's illuminating, and the knowledge and illumination arises out of the heart. Okay, a third verse. I am the self, O conqueror of sleep, seated in the hearts of all creatures. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all beings. And the last, one who sees the super soul accompanying the individual soul in all bodies understands that neither the soul nor the super soul is ever destroyed, actually sees. Okay, so the secret, what is the secret? The secret is that your true nature of self has to do with the nature of the human heart and the higher dimensional nature of the human heart. Because the heart is not simply a material organ, although that's an aspect of its function, the physical heart. In a way, the heart is a multidimensional entity. In a way, there's a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and ultimately a divine element within the highest dimension of the heart. In the Vedas, it's called the Jiva Atma. The individual soul is described as infinitesimal, like a spiritual spark, and that's in the heart. And it's this presence of self that initiates the heart's beat and ensouls the living organism through the actions of the heart, the electromagnetic dynamics of the heart, and through the breath, which distributes the oxygen through the body and vitalizes the body. So the spiritual soul is connected to the actions of the heart and to the actions of the breath. In Kabbalah, the different levels of self, and there are five of them, are connected to different levels of the breath. And in the Bible, God breathes into man a living soul. So a person is ensouled through the heart and the circulation of blood, and the oxygenation of the body. That's the basis of mystical teachings. So I say that is a secret, because most people who are in a particular religion don't quite realize what that means if that's true, if that the true self of an individual is really connected to the dimensions of the heart. The whole last century of modern psychology and science has denied the existence of the human spirit and soul and convinced people through a simplistic materialistic philosophy that we are simply higher primates or material organisms, and that you live and you die with your body, but there's nothing in you that could persist beyond death. That's what is considered the scientific view in modern times. And that, in fact, has become a dogma. A dogma. It's not because the claims that the mind in the head produces consciousness, these are not scientifically established, how or what that entails or how that is done. It is simply assumed that this is so, but really there is no evidences for it. And in fact, there's many evidences to the contrary, that human consciousness is not simply up in the mind, in the brain. If you study yourself through self-study, you become more aware of how your consciousness can be distributed through the whole of yourself. You can be conscious in your abdomen. If you eat a big meal and your blood flows to your abdomen, it feels like your consciousness is in your gut. Or your consciousness is connected to your blood flow. And consciousness can be throughout the body. Consciousness is also in subtle bodies, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. In the material body, consciousness is connected to the blood flow. So my secret that I'm sharing at the beginning is this whole concept that an individual human being, in a way, does have a real I, like an I, where we say I, like individual I, something that is an entity or unity or something in him. Okay, we'll see later. I'm going to critique a recent article in Time magazine on the mind brain and the mysteries of consciousness, and I'll review and critique that. And you see how modern theorists have completely wrong ideas about consciousness, no idea about what's supposed to be involved in the spirit or soul. But I'll come to that. So I articulate the heart doctrine, that the secret of self, the secret is knowing the self within the heart. And this is elaborated in Kabbalah and Judaism, in mystical Christianity, in the Vedas, by the Dalai Lama, by Madame Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, by Sai Baba talks of this, Adi Da. All these genuine mystics, I would say, elaborate the esoteric or hidden teaching of the heart, the self being connected to the heart. So in life, in the mystical path or spiritual path, we want to experience the awakening of the human heart. Now, people talk about the evolution of consciousness. People often talk of this. And the way I understand this one is consider the self connected to the heart. And there are said to be three energy centers or chakras below the level of the heart. And those in yoga psychology are often connected to the motives of money, sex, and power. So much of ordinary human life is the pursuit of money, sex, and power. If you turn on your TV, you just see all the time the kind of titillation of things and the importance of power and all the politics and the world situation is all like power struggles and the sexuality, money, sex, and power. It's kind of, and in a way, those three, money, sex, and power, are manifestations of a human being's lower material nature. That's what all you pursue, money, sex, and power, that's your pursuit. From a mystical perspective, it is only when we attain to the fourth level of the opening of the heart center, that's when we experience the next evolutionary level of human consciousness, called self-realization, or consciousness of self, the true self. Not initially that you understand it at its deepest level, because it's something, that experience of what that is something that grows over you progressively over time as you cultivated and learn to abide in heart consciousness. Dr. Mishra, an endocrinologist and yogi teachings, who wrote several excellent kind of scholarly books on the science of yoga and psychology of yoga. He says, physical consciousness and the physical heart are connected. And then you want to attain spiritual consciousness connected to the spiritual heart. So the idea that there's the spiritual heart is connected somehow to the material heart. So if a person in their heart turns downward, then that consciousness becomes engrossed with money, sex, and power. in a way, that heart is a material heart, is kind of turned downwards. Imagine it as a downward turned triangle. Okay, now if a person then awakens in the heart and can become upright of heart, imagine flipping that lower turned triangle, flipping it up right side up so it's pointing upwards. That represents like the higher spiritual nature. So I would put a triangle turned upwards above the heart center, because there are three higher centers, or three centers higher than the heart, spiritual centers that can be awakened once the heart center has been awakened. So you might imagine then the upper triangle and the lower triangle being overlapped, and you have six-pointed Star of David. And you put a center point in it, and that center point is the Jiva Atma within the heart. So that Jiva Atma can be taken down and controlled by material nature, or it can, ideally through awakening, attain the higher spiritual levels of being. Okay, so what I'm saying is, my secret I'm sharing with you is the idea that we in the heart need to, the spiritual heart is turned upwards, like as if it's burning upwards while the material heart is turned downwards. So as a person's heart is in the way, so shall he or she be. So in a way, the nature and condition of a human heart is like the essential thing in human existence. And we need to understand these mysteries of the heart. So I actually say there's a whole physics and metaphysics to what the heart actually is. And I'm not going to go into all the complexity of that at the moment. Okay, so that's some of the heart teaching that I share through these zero-point studies. And now I'm going to go to the movie, The Secret, or the DVD, and I'm going to kind of read my review of this and kind of articulate a little bit more on it as I go through. Okay, The Secret, and of the cult of narcissism. The magician suggested to his sheep that they were not sheep at all. To some of them, he suggested they were lions. To others, that they were eagles. To others, that they were men. And to others, that they were magicians. That's a quote from G.I. Gurdjieff from Uspensky's book In Search of the Miraculous. The Secret is a newly published book by Ron DeBarn, available also in the movie version on DVD. The author and individuals featured on the DV have recently gained considerable exposure through the media, from Larry King Live on CNN to Ellen DeGeneres, and most recently on Oprah twice. If ever there was a book and movie to convince sheep that they are magicians or can fly, this is it. Although there are some valuable insights and teachings within The Secret, this is another instance of what I would call new think, pseudo-mystical, new age pablum propagated to elude and deceive people as to their true situation and how they are about to be skinned. Although people imagine The Secret to be a spiritual teaching, it is not. In fact, it is a superficial attempt to spiritualize materialism and directly opposed to the paths of mystical attainment and higher magic. In brief, The Secret, revealed in The Secret, is the law of attraction, and that like attracts like. This supposed secret is supposed to be known. It is supposed to have been known. I'm getting some interference on my phone here. This supposed secret is supposed to have been known to a series of philosophers and magus through the eons of time, but hidden because of its mysterious power. even Einstein's image flashes across the screen to reinforce the secretness of this big secret. Thus, if we think positive thoughts and imagine positive things for ourselves, then these things will magically appear in our life. The big secret is about how to actualize those things that most people want in life. Varied forms of money, sex, and power. To be successful and gain recognition, to have your dreams come true, a new romance, and even to get a new car, house, or home improvements, even a parking lot. All of these things are offered by the quantum magic of the secret. This is a secret for imaginary wish fulfillment and actualizing your desires, just like a lottery ticket. The secret is proposed as the key to unlocking the meaning of life, making you a real magician instead of a sheep. Now, the basic idea of the secret is actually in conformity with Aleister Crowley's definition of magic as making things happen in conformity with will. The secret suggests that we can so envision what we want, and because of our entanglement with the universe, these things can manifest in reality. Quantum magic for sheep. Knowing the secret is compared in the movie to having a genie in an urn, but instead of having just three wishes, we can have as many as we want. Generally, the aim of those espousing the secret are for material and financial gain, new possessions, romances, and business success, and personal confidence. We want to love ourselves in a cult of narcissism and to be satisfied and gorged to satiety while atrocities are committed around the world and within our communities. Our nations are run by donkeys and idiots, cruel elites and deceivers, but we have a new form of quantum wish fulfillment based on self-centeredness and self-love. Oh boy, big secret, bound to be a big hit. Firstly, in passing, like doesn't always attract like. In nature, opposites attract, and like often repels like. Positive electrical charges, negative electrical charges attract, as do the north and south electromagnetic poles. Men and women are attracted to each other as opposites, and even within gay couples, opposite types similarly attract. Like often repels like. Of course, in other contexts, like does attract like. If you are cruel to other people and terrorize them, then they may want to be cruel back towards you and terrorize you. If you are loving and compassionate, you may be loved back. If you have money, it is easier to make money. If you change your self-defeating patterns of thinking and feeling, of scarcity and struggle, it may help you move forward and actualize some of those things you have not yet attained. There are valuable lessons in this movie and teaching in some regards. It is only if a person expands their horizons beyond themselves, maybe to other peoples of the world, that the self-centered focus of the secret becomes apparent. The secret is like a key to narcissism, a new religion for baby boomers who have been gorged to satiety. I do not mean to be mean to the author or facilitators of The Big Secret, nor to Oprah and other hosts who feature their work. I'm a big Oprah fan, and Ellen, The View, and of other popular shows, and there will be some things in this false teaching which could help different people resolve issues at personal and egoic levels, which can be valuable. It is only when I regard the secret in the broader context of the psychopathology of modern humanity that the deceits of the media and Hollywood and such, that the superficial and hypnotic nature of this big secret is apparent. It teaches us how to fulfill our egoic and material needs while ignoring the rampant criminal activity and terrorism within our own society. not as committed by imaginary Muslims, Christians, or Jews, but as perpetrated by psychopaths and deviants who came to rule the human race. The human race was not intended to become a rat race, controlled by a pseudo-master race, and to become a slave race. And yet, this is what has happened. And humankind faces a task like that of Arjuna in the Gita, where the forces of light and love gather on the battlefield to face those forces of cruelty and deceit. To understand the positions of human beings on planet Earth, it is useful to quote this material from mystic G.I. Gurdjieff about the hypnosis and delusions of humankind, the sheep being led unconsciously to slaughter while buying into the cult of narcissism and sacrificing care to a great horny owl in reference to the satanic practices conducted at Bohemian Grove. First of all, Gurdjieff writes, it must be realized that the sleep, in which man exists is not normal, but hypnotic sleep. Man is hypnotized, and this hypnotic state is continually maintained and strengthened in him. One would think that there are forces for whom it is useful and profitable to keep man in a hypnotic state and prevent him from seeing the truth and understanding his position. There is an Eastern tale which speaks about a very rich magician who had a great many sheep, but at the same time this magician was very mean. He did not want to hire shepherds, nor did he want to erect a fence about the pasture where his sheep were grazing. The sheep consequently often wandered into the forest, fell into ravines, and so on, and above all, they ran away, for they knew that the magician wanted their flesh and skins, and this they did not like. At last, the magician found a remedy. He hypnotized the sheep and suggested to them, first of all, that they were immortal and that no harm was being done to them when they were skinned. That on the contrary, it would be very good for them and even pleasant. Secondly, he suggested that the magician was a good master who loved his flock so much that he was ready to do anything in the world for them. And in the third place, he suggested to them that if anything at all were going to happen to them, it was not going to happen just then, at any rate not that day, and therefore they had no reason to think about it. Further, the magician suggested to his sheep that they were not sheep at all. To some of them he suggested that they were lions, to others that they were eagles, to others that they were men, and to others that they were magicians. After this, all his cares and worries about the sheep came to an end. They never ran away again, but quietly awaited the time when the magician would require their flesh and skins. This tale is a very good illustration of man's position. That's the end of the quotation from Gurdjieff. Final note in my review, the Hollywood lies became more essential to the life of humanity than the life of the holy world. What a sad and pathetic tale. What a sad and pathetic big secret. Jim. Yeah, hi. Okay, yeah. That was my introduction. That was my review of The Secret.
Yeah,
I wanted to fill it in a little bit more because there's other valuable content in the movie and such. I had wanted to balance it a bit more, but that
fell
gives
asleep.
My...
I fell asleep during the movie. I was
oh, you
sorry.
Did you try to watch it?
No, I'm just kidding. Well, it's an interesting review. Interesting movie.
Yeah, you should see the movie. I mean,
yeah,
I think
well,
as I...
But as you say, like, I mean, it already... I will see it, but, I mean, it already kind of, you know... You spoke of it a couple of weeks ago briefly, and it just
yeah.
The idea that it's, you know, the secret is this way for you to get more of what you can't get already. It's just so
yeah.
Kind of... off base and just feeds all, like, you know, you say it's narcissistic, okay? It's like
yeah.
Just, it's such a, it's such offensive, it's so offensive to the real kind of nature of those spiritual teachings and the real goal. Like, there's no, I don't hear anything in there but suffering or sacrifice or service, you know, like all of
no,
them are
no.
part of the real spiritual path and the, you know, legitimate goals of people. It's kind of, as you say, it's, you know, it's for baby boomers, and I just wouldn't put it on baby boomers, but just...
No, I wouldn't either. That you're
for,
right.
But it's a good group to criticize, because, you know, I mean, it's...
No, you're right. It's not just baby boomers.
No,
in fact,
it's
probably
just,
less so.
It's just the whole Western ethos is that, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
like you can get something for nothing. And, I mean, if there's one thing that, you know, that we know, it's that there's no free lunch, you know? I mean... I like the lottery analogy, because that's what it is. It's like a piece of dumb luck is gonna make your life much better, you know. And I mean, sometimes dumb luck does make your life better, but you don't really want to count on it unless, you know, you're happy with your skin and your coat being sacrificed to the magician, you know.
And it's also, to me, like, in a way, to me, spirituality is living in spiritual truth. One thing is, to live in spiritual truth, we have to realize the truth of the situation that we are in as an individual, in the family, in the community, in the country, in the world. And what's happening, like, in a way, I feel now that my family is humankind, in a way. That I feel that kind of identification with humanity. Like, in a way, I turn on the news and watch these horrible things done in Iraq and elsewhere around the world. It's horrifying. It's terrible. Horrendous around the world. And we're kind of like, we're kind of at the moment, we got all these nuclear arsenals amassing in the Middle East, and we're in danger of a third world war that's kind of brought about through the madness of humankind and us not seeing ourselves, what we've done and what we've become and what's happening.
Well, it's
so incredible. So I can't understand how people think, oh, they can be spiritual and have the things they want, the new romance and all these nice things, you know, and fancy pants and whatever, while these things are happening in life and in the world and to humanity.
That should be the giveaway right there. Interestingly, nobody's talking about a secret which leads somebody to discover a cure for cancer or cholera or, you know, some AIDS or some horrible disease that kills, you know, millions and millions of people, or a better energy system that's, you know, going to help the earth.
Oh.
Are you getting that echo?
I lost you for a moment, actually.
I was getting a bit of an echo.
In a bit here.
I'm getting a bit of an echo. Okay, I'm okay now. Yeah, I mean, but it's, you know, it's all egocentric. It's quite childish in a way. The whole focus of it is, like, you know, it's just more of the same. And
I think one of the comments I found most in the movie, most offensive actually, was at one point how they were kind of saying, you know, you bring about yourself what you worry about or what you think about. So if you don't worry about war, they said,
yeah.
Because if you worry about war, then you're going to bring it back about on yourself. And they said, like, don't get out and join anti-war movements, because, you know, then you're going to cause the war, you know. And ministry of doublethink. Okay, don't get into the anti-peace movement because by not wanting war, you're going to be the ones that create the war. Like, excuse me. Like,
well, that's completely moronic, you know. But even, you know, like, I think the underlying message here is about the power of visualization and positive thinking, and as I said a couple of weeks ago, I mean, I find that incredibly ridiculous in terms of there's a truth there, but it's not at all the truth that they're trying to promote. Like, as I say, you know, it's like the old thing, the New Age idea that you create your own reality. Well, it's just so fascistic, that whole idea. There are millions of people who are living in the most incredible misery, and I'm sure if they really felt that, they probably prayed every day that they'd be delivered from these awful circumstances that they're in, and yet they remain in them, so it's not quite that you make your own reality that way. You can change the meaning of things by being more conscious and being more aware and not being hypnotized and not being governed by your conditioning, but it's
much
more complicated. Then there's
and the movie addresses some of that. Those are the valuable aspects to the movie.
There's both a spiritual and a magical tradition in terms of, you know, as you mentioned, Crowley, of you know, visualization and magical practices. I mean, Tibetan Buddhism, it's a, you know, visualization's a very important practice, but it's like everything else. It requires a long and hard effort and discipline and a lot of undoing of automatic psychological processes that interfere with your, it's like you can't just kind of, you know, hear about the secret and then start going around visualizing things are going to come true and you know.
Yeah, in a way you have to bring your level of being up to the level where that secret might
You have to develop the consciousness and the being, exactly, the level of being to be capable of doing these things. It's, you know, it's like another thing that a lot of people, when you talk about developing consciousness, they say, well, and you talk about the intellectual ideas associated with it, and they say, well, it's just intellectualizing things. I'd just rather go with the flow, you know, and just, you know, not, I find that thought interferes and everything. Well, thought interferes on a certain level, but nobody can go with the flow. When they're going with the flow, they're hypnotized, you know. You want to develop that capacity to just be, but the thing is to recognize that you don't possess it in your normal state, that it requires long and difficult effort. You know, it's like,
yeah, that's why the idea that magic, the sheep think they're magicians now. You know?
Yeah.
I like that line, quantum magic for sheep.
Exactly.
You can say a sheep, but you can be a magician. It's such a funny story, that.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, who was the author of the book the movie's based on?
The Secret?
Yeah.
Rhonda Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E.
Huh.
Yeah, it came out of the tradition of, like, think positively and grow rich, like that kind of positive thing. It comes out of that kind of movement that goes back to the 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like just really basically an updated version of Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of
Positive
Thinking.
That line.
Yeah.
See, that's why I always like that analogy. See, people have been negatively conditioned, and then a program like this tries to institute positive conditioning. And then the mystical path, in a way, is to be unconditioned.
Yeah, but it's
and I think that's not this is trying to encourage you positive thinking, you know, rather than negative. But it's still being conditioned. And in their program, it's still being conditioned to all the satisfaction of your personal and egoic kind of needs. But it leaves you conditioned. And unless we awaken more, then you know, if you attain self and your heart does open, then you kind of wake up and become aware more of what's happening in the world around you. And that just breaks down that false egoism of that lower kind of personality makeup.
Yeah, it's like we talked about last time about even in therapy, generally in therapy, you're trying to replace, you know, the goal of most Western therapies is to replace one type of conditioning with another type of conditioning, but there's no active attempt to realize transformation of consciousness and being, and really what the mystical spiritual path teaches is the idea that what you need is what's called metanoia, which is Greek for change of mind, which means literally a change of mind. Now, you know, not a replacement of one type of conditioning with another, but a change in the way that you're actually mindful, and that involves developing proper consciousness and higher levels of being.
Yeah, a more fundamental kind of radical quantum shift in consciousness. I see that's what I see is the people need to understand the next level in human consciousness is this awakening of the heart center. And people generally have so little concept of that, and this whole false dogma of the mind and consciousness all being in the mind, in the head. I just yesterday picked up the new copy, January 26th of this year, of Time magazine. They had a special on mind and body, and they had an article on the mystery of consciousness. Oh, and the whole thing throughout is kind of identifying consciousness as simply in the mind and connected to the brain. At one point, they have on the front cover, they had a picture of a head, and they have a sign just behind the eyes, an arrow. It says emotion, and it's kind of pointing to a part of the brain that your emotion now has nothing to do with the heart or soul anymore. Now they think that emotion is kind of, created out of limbic system structures, It's so kind of delusional. At one point, they showed that little heart up on the prefrontal cortex of the brain, like your feelings are up, and they have a little heart up on their picture of the brain. It's so funny. So I see this as an intentional. I used to think that these people were just stupid, but now I actually think a lot of this is intentional propaganda, intentional misperception. That's how I saw it. It struck me in because it struck me reading this in this magazine.
But it's towards
the end of the article.
But it's so explicable in terms of historical forces. I mean, it's really only in the last 350 years or so that this has happened, and it's because all consciousness and animism and spirit and soul have been driven out by the post-Newtonian worldview in modern science. The whole history of 20th century psychology is first of all, consciousness just was driven right out by the behaviorists. It didn't even exist. But then people eventually, after about 40 years, realized that's crazy. But also, people think about it, and they think that consciousness is thinking, and they think it's the contents of awareness, and all of that occurs in your brain. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary, but in a way, I think it's quite explicable. I mean, I don't think it's intentional so much as I just think I think people are just deluded. I think they're really quite mistaken about it all.
I used to think because
they're intellectuals. They start thinking about consciousness, and they think, well, where's consciousness? And they're thinking about it, and they think it's in their brain. I mean, obviously, the other thing too is the incredible development of research in the brain, and there's so much more that we know about how the brain functions in a way, and in other ways we really don't understand it. But I mean, it's like they're looking for, they're looking where there's more light, and they're putting all the light on the brain, and they're kind of missing the big picture. But I'd say that's really quite consistent with what's happened in thinking in the Western thought, is that it's just all consciousness and awareness has been taken out of the universe and progressively stripped of everything that's been taken out of everything in nature, and it all winds up in the cerebral cortex, not even the brain almost. It's just people think it's that consciousness is in the cerebral cortex, and then they just make things up and say, the cerebral cortex produces consciousness, even though nobody really knows that, because there is no proof of that. There's no evidence of that, and it's like correlation. They're correlating things and misperceiving them and thinking that the brain causes consciousness. But I'm not really sure that it's. I mean, intentional for what purpose?
Because I think it's been to undermine consideration of religious psychology, spiritual, mystical psychology, investigation of psychical phenomena. What I see is, I did that internet survey, Canadian universities, 13 universities. How many professors out of 600 had any interest in psychology as mystical spiritual psychology or study of psychical phenomena or even the study of consciousness? Out of 600 professors, there was not a single one. Okay. Out of all the courses offered at graduate and undergraduate levels across Canada, hundreds and hundreds of undergraduate and graduate courses, there were only a few courses taught in one Alberta university, no, Saskatchewan, University of Saskatchewan, across the whole of Canada where people could teach these areas, these subjects. There's been a taboo in a way that I see now. I think in a way what happened is the early behaviorism became tied into the Nazi-type movement with the whole Skinnerian psychology. All the modern mind-brainwashing techniques developed is all based on aversive conditioning, classical conditioning, all this kind of mind-brain conditioning thing. That's what's been used and developed in the intelligence community as a model for human beings. All to dehumanize people. I see it now as a more conscious effort to give a false teaching, to try to substitute this pseudoscience for religion and to undermine religion. So here, listen to this as their second last quote in this article. At one point, he's saying how he thinks. He says how he thinks evolutionary biology is what will give us the basis for a new morality rather than belief in God. And then towards the end, and he says, and when you think about it, the doctrine of a life to come is not much of an uplifting idea after all, because it necessarily devalues life on Earth. Just remember, the most famous people in recent memory who acted in expectation of a reward in the hereafter, the conspirators who hijacked the airlines on 9/11. See, what he's trying to portray, it's these religious fanatics who hijacked the airplane, and they believed in something beyond death. So that, you know, that's where it leads you to become a terrorist if you have a religious concept of the nature of man.
Well, I mean, you know, that's who says that? I mean, that's one person. I mean, there's a whole critique of the whole right-wing fundamentalist religious right in the United States, which basically that's exactly what they believe, and they're responsible for George Bush being in the White House. You know, I mean, I'd say that, you know, I mean, your point about, you know, I mean, the CIA was the ones doing the research on LSD originally. I don't think it has to be really that conscious. I mean, there's all sorts of information out there about alternative understandings of the mind and consciousness and awareness and spirituality and religion.
Well,
people just don't care. I mean, you know, you tell people this. You even, you know, you give them your book, you know, or your books, and people read it. They just don't get it, you know. I mean, they don't have to be conspired to create that condition. Most people aren't really interested in it. Like, you tell them that they're asleep and try to suggest how they can study themselves and see themselves as sleepwalkers, and they say, I don't get it, you know, I don't see that. I mean, it's like, it's sort of like, you know, it's part of, part is culturally determined, I would suppose, on a certain level. It's just, I think it's more like the way we live, that people are so cut off from what they are or what they could be in themselves, that it's like, it doesn't require like a gross conspiracy. I think that people exploit that. I mean, I think they definitely exploit that, but that level of sleep and that kind of dullness and thickness to the way things are, and that, you know, people are also satisfied by little transitory things like a secret that'll get them a bigger car, you know, and they lose sight of the big picture. But I don't think it requires like an act of conspiracy. I just think people are just wrong. I mean, you know, I think it's that simple, you know.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's just recently I've seen it more as not because I see the New World Order in a way wants to eliminate religion and create the belief among people that religion is kind of the cause of conflicts. They don't want people to perceive that it's really criminals who do it, these things, rather than it being one religious or another group. Because I see the religions all espouse, as I say, the heart doctrine. So religions are more unified as a philosophy and science.
I completely disagree with that. I mean, I think that's just dead wrong, because I don't think religions do see that. I think most religions are completely cut off from the roots and to completely misrepresent. I mean, you know, I would say that fundamentalists everywhere are basically, they're not religious because they don't want to kill somebody in God's name. And I mean, that right there, that takes up I see a lot of Christians, a lot of Muslims, a lot of Jews, you know, a lot of people the world over. It's like, I mean, as you say, you know, George Bush calls himself a Christian. He thinks he's a Christian. I mean, did you think he's a Christian? I mean, he's about as far from a Christian as you could possibly get, you know. And he very strongly believes in his Christianity. It's very important to him. But he's
well, religious. That is what's said. I mean,
serious. Oh, yeah, but he does. I mean, it's, you know, how can you get on a plane and blow somebody up? Or how can you blow somebody up? How can you drop a bomb on anybody? How can you invent a bomb if you really believe you're religious?
Really, we're Christian. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, you know, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, real. Yeah.
And that's why I say, I mean, I think, you know, religion in the last, you know, 1,000 years, I mean, things have been done in the name of God. Is, you know, he couldn't stop throwing up if he had the countenance at all. But on the other hand, you know, the people who criticize religion conveniently forget that in the 20th century, you know, the two huge experiments in communism and secularism in the Soviet Union and China, they murdered millions of people, too.
Terrible, too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, they didn't have religion. So, I mean, to me, all this stuff about this talk about whether it's, you know, you have to distinguish between the level of consciousness of religion. It's like Gurdjieff said, there's a religion of different people, you know. There's a religion of an intellectual type, and it's about theorems and ideas and proofs and arguments about the existence of God. Then there's a more emotional religion, and that's a religion of, you know, of extreme feeling and ritual. And then there's a more physical and practical religion, you know. But those are all religions of people who are asleep. And then there's the religion of a conscious person, and it's completely different because religion...
Yeah, like
from
the fourth level.
Yeah, fourth level, because it's different from the religion of the people who are asleep, because religion consists of not only in what's to be done, but how to do it. And that's what's really lost in modern religion, is that, you know, people think, as he says, you know, people call them Christians, but who can be a Christian if you're a sleepwalker and everything happens to you and you can't do? How can you possibly, you know, practice Christ's teachings? I mean, you just can't. And so, like, on that level, like, I mean, I would say a lot of the debate between science and religion is quite phony, because, you know, it depends on, well, what kind of religion are you talking about, you know? There are all sorts of people who believe all sorts of stupid things.
Yeah, the dogmas of fundamentalism or esoteric.
And then there's the dogma of science, you know, that we are higher primates that accidentally evolved, you know, in a purposeless random universe that just happened to, you know, create all these wonderful things, including us, and you know, that consciousness exists in our brain. And I mean, you know, it all of these things are open to question. And I would say that the esoteric mystical perspective provides an entirely different basis on which to understand yourself and to understand the cosmos and to understand everything in between, basically, and that the more conscious you are, the more you become awake to the reality of the massive hypnosis that, you know, that life on Earth is governed by, you know, that everybody's asleep.
Yeah, the sleepwalking state of mankind.
Yeah,
that quote from Gurdjieff, I remember reading that like 20 years ago. He says, we think we're the Earth. We think we're ruled by a group of conscious people. Where are they? Who are they? In fact, it's exactly the opposite. We're kind of ruled by those who are least conscious, most asleep, and so on.
And then he goes on in the same quote, and he says that contemporary culture requires automatons, and the worst thing that's happening is that people are becoming more and more like machines and have less and less idea as to the very low level of existence on this planet, you know. He died in 1949. I'd love to hear what he'd have to say about the contemporary state of humanity. You know, this is pre-technological explosion, you know, television and the internet and jet travel and nuclear weapons and chemical weapons. It's quite a horror show going on here on planet Earth.
It really is. It's very sad.
I think the other side of what you were saying is that people have to awaken to the fact that, you know, all this you know, the it's interesting, I mean, listening to, for instance, like the Bush administrations, you know, how often they talk about democracy and freedom, and it's like, you know, Joseph Goebbels and Hitler's minister of propaganda, you know, his whole idea was that if you tell a lie often enough, people will believe it. And it's like democracy, freedom, you know what I mean? But then you look at the career of George Bush, and I mean, he's about the farthest thing from a Democrat, a small d Democrat, that anybody could imagine, you know? He's more like some sort of little feudal prince that got placed on the American throne by the Supreme Court and by a bunch of criminals that surround him, you know? I mean, but he loves democracy. Well, he loves democracy about as much as, you know, as I love him, which is not very much. I mean, it's just all these keywords that are supposed to condition these responses in people. We hate the enemy. You know, we're under siege by the enemy. Well, the enemy isn't outside. It's inside of us, you know, and it's inside our society, too, you know.
I think that, in a way, is kind of a bit of what's horrified me most, is seeing how much the media has been a part of this kind of brainwash of the public to keep people asleep and kind of deceived about really what everything is and what's happening. You know, that is really discouraging to me to see that. You know, it's not just these kind of psychopaths in power. It's this whole kind of conspiracy of silence and deceit. You know, it's just so rampant. It's so huge, you know. And it's wake up people, you know, turn around. Like, you know, we can't go forward. And when do we ever learn? Oh, I know one thing I really wanted to ask you just before I forget. You know how Jewish people say, like, we will never forget. Like, we always have to remember, meaning remember the Holocaust, and that'll never happen again, okay?
Yeah.
When they say that, does that apply to other people? Kind of like, it'll never happen again, we'll never have genocide against someone else? Or does that just, we'll never forget and never let anyone commit genocide against us?
Well,
is that for anyone, or is that,
I think it's like everything else, you know. I think for a lot of Jewish people, I think it's definitely, you know, that it'll never happen again, you know, and that they're
to anybody.
And
that's what I always thought.
Well, that's like
I
Eli
thought that because they experienced it, they know.
Yeah,
that
but of course it happened. Of course, it has happened again. I mean, it just happened
but
in Rwanda, you know what I mean? And
but then
there are other people who it's like we'll never allow it to happen to the Jews again. You know, I mean, like to us. You know, I mean, there are people with broader understanding of it. But I think in general, I think most of the people that actually experienced it, like, they don't want it to ever happen to anybody, you know? Like,
yeah, that's what I thought. I assumed it was that.
That the world turned their backs on their situation, and you know, that we should never turn our backs on anybody, but of course, like, it has happened. Oh, by the way.
Did you see, wow, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, my name's Jim Moffat, because you didn't introduce me today, so I just...
I'm sorry, Jim.
That's okay.
Oh, yeah, no, I called you a guest. I shouldn't really have called you a guest, because you're
not
regularly here.
Yeah, I'm a secret guest with a big secret that,
so many interesting news and things happening around the world. I did want to mention to listeners, I do encourage people... if you have a pen there, to sometime go to www.prisonplanet.com and listen to Alex Jones, who I would say is one of the most knowledgeable and crusading individual who's trying to kind of bring the truth out and kind of challenge a new world order. And I think there's a whole community of people now who connect through Alex Jones' network of growing number of people. You wouldn't believe who he had on his show in the last week. He had Dylan Avery from Loose Change. He had the film producer of the BBC cover-up thing on 9/11 that was shown this last week. He had David Ray Griffin, you mentioned before.
Yep. Yeah.
He interviews all these people. It's an amazing show. You can get it free anytime online. So I've gotten in the habit of a little bit of listening to Alex Jones to kind of learn of what's happening, and I did want to mention that to promote that people, you know, it's shocking a bit.
Yeah, I would recommend people look at David Ray Griffin's work on 9/11. I think it's really interesting. You know, he's quite a he's a really interesting guy. Like in terms of his books, he teaches in California. I think he's actually a retired professor, but he is very interested in religion, spirituality, and science, and also parapsychology. Yeah, he's got several books out. Yeah, and he's also writes about the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead and science and spirituality in the 20th century. He's a really, really interesting guy. But his 9/11 work is that's one of the first people that sort of alerted me to the idea that, you know, that maybe this, the whole truth wasn't here. And I liked his book about, his first book about 9/11. He just asked, you know, like, why aren't these questions, why aren't they asked? And you know, he has like varying levels of complicity. If 9/11 was an inside job, what are the levels of complicity of the government? And then he goes through the different, you know, the different different levels. But his work is very interesting. But also, like, you know, there's this whole, I'm surprised that there have been different conferences and things, but, you know, the idea has been put forward that there should be an international commission to study 9/11, to have an actual open inquiry into 9/11, and, you know, and have it conducted not by the American government, but by an international commission
worldwide done 9/11 truth hearings. That's what I thought.
World
9/11 truth hearings.
Let's hear what the evidence is and what it isn't. I mean, you have to read quite a bit to find out about, you know, what exactly the different stories that the military provided about what happened that day in terms of where was the Air Force, you know, through all this and what was exactly.
Everything is I mean, there's so much evidence. I mean, it's overwhelming, you know. I don't even bother in a way with some of the details anymore.
Well, but it, you know, I mean, it would completely change things if you know, these questions were asked openly and honestly.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and by, you know, as I say, by a commission of people that that have some credibility, because, I mean, really, the 9/11 Commission, as I said, I think I said the last time we were talking about, David Ray Griffin calls it the, however number of pages, he calls it the 800-page lie or whatever it is.
Yeah, I heard that.
And he has 101 questions that for the 9/11 Commission about, you know, he says are outright falsehoods and distortions, you know, that have to be answered, so... that's interesting work. You know, it's funny, one thing that you were talking about the media and everything, I was thinking about this, that do you know The Daily Show with Jon Stewart?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the really interesting things about Jon Stewart shows, I mean, this is, you know, these guys are comedy writers, and they're very clever, they're very funny. But really, on the political stuff, you know what's really interesting about watching that is, really, they do the job that the media should do, and what they do that is most interesting to me is all they do is they take videotape of these guys, these public figures, you know, members of the government, and they just play the statements that they made 6 months ago and 2 years ago and 3 years ago, and then they play them consecutively, and you just see, like, you know, how they're complete liars and how they completely distort things and change things to, you know, to sell their little tune today. But people have no cultural memory, so they forget.
No.
People are so caught up in, like, what's happening this week and what's happening, you know, now,
that
they completely, like, you know, it's amazing when you hear these guys, you know, and then that's what's so funny about that show is all do, a lot of it sort of writes itself in a sense. All they do is they collect the information and then they just juxtapose all these different lies, and it's quite hilarious, you know. Like, I mean, then you really it's quite brilliant, you know, what the way they do it. I think, you know, like, I know before he retired, Ted Koppel, who, you know, used to host Nightline, was complaining that a lot of young Americans got their news from The Daily Show, and I'm thinking, yeah, but it's because they have better coverage than the networks. I mean, they're a comedy.
Yeah.
They're a fake news show, and they do a better job than the quote-unquote real news show.
That's like Rick Mercer in Canada.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the best news. That and The Hour is a good source of it on CBC.
Yeah.
And
it's very funny, actually. Yeah. Oh, shoot.
Yeah. Anyway,
maybe you could talk. I was going to ask
I had said that I was going to open the lines up here, and I've gone a little bit over. Why don't I just give these numbers out?
Sure.
And then if anyone calls in, Don or whoever is on there could just patch them through. In the U.S., it's 877-876-5227. In Canada, it's 888-810-8322. So for the remainder of our show, we got about 40 minutes left. If anyone would like to call in, we'll carry on. And if someone calls in, we may have to tie up what we're saying, Jim, and then we'll just switch right over. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Good.
I was going to ask you if you might amplify a little bit just on the basis, basic ideas of what you call a heart doctrine versus a head doctrine.
Okay, so I'm actually trying to explore what is taught in mystical teachings, that there is some jiva atma, it's called in Vedic teachings, described as like a spiritual spark, a point source of light established in the higher dimensional space underlying the physical heart. This is the kind of model that I'm working at, that we actually have a jiva atma or a monad, what Shirley MacLaine referred to as a God spark, that there is some higher dimensional entity connected to the material heart, and that the heart embodies or houses this higher dimensional element. So so I'm saying that consciousness is actually light. In a way, we need to understand consciousness as light, and this element within the heart is self-illuminating like the sun. That's why people in awakening to self, you feel and experience illumination or enlightenment. You have actually experienced light and illumination. So consciousness itself involves this kind of inner illumination. The idea is that originates from the heart. And the mystical teachings, see, when I critique the head doctrine, I'm not saying that there's no consciousness in the head, and I'm not saying there aren't faculties of mind in the brain. I'm not saying that at all. I know that to be true. You know, I've studied neuropsychology and neurophysiology, and that's undoubtedly true. But the fact that there are cognitive elements in different parts of the brain and emotional reactions in the limbic system, all of that doesn't mean the consciousness is only in the head, and that the heart is actually the center of a human being as a quantum system. The electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times as powerful as the electromagnetic volume of the brain in the head. So I'm saying that consciousness in the human being originates out of the depth of the heart, and then it's distributed through the body related to the blood and the subtle bodies. So I'm saying there's this whole inner science of what consciousness is. I'll stop at that. Any comment, Jim, or anything you'd like to... I mean, it's such a complex... To really grasp what's meant by this.
It's
so complex. And it's not just acquiring it, the knowledge of it, but like progressively experiences of it.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that about, you know, that you're not saying that consciousness doesn't exist in the brain. And that's like in the Gurdjieff work in the Fourth Way teaching, he says that we're three brain beings and that we have three distinct and separate minds, or that we, to understand our normal consciousness, we have to see that it's an interaction between our thinking brain, which is centered in the head brain, and then an emotional brain, which is centered in the nerve plexus of the abdomen, particularly in the cardiac plexus. And then we have a moving instinctual, like a physical brain, which is centered in our spinal column, and that these three brains interact. Somebody?
Do we have a question? A caller?
Yeah, hi.
My
name is Philip. I'm calling from Montreal.
Hi, Philip.
Fellow Canadian. How are you, Christopher?
Hey, Philip.
Good. Please jump in and ask any question or make any comment or share whatever you'd like to share.
So thanks. I just want to say, first of all, I heard you on Coast to Coast. My first exposure to your work was from Coast to Coast, and I'm very interested and impressed, actually, with a lot of your work. I happen to have read, you are the first person I've come across in all my research, and my research background is physics, so I'll get to that in a moment. You are the first person who has mentioned Gurdjieff's work or Uspensky's work, and in that vein, I want to comment on your heart model. In referencing the heart and the role of... Pardon me?
Go ahead.
Yeah, in referencing the heart and the role of the heart, I think perhaps the key might be to interpret the word heart as actually center. And the center, and from a physics standpoint, the center of all systems is extremely difficult to measure, and it's a locus of basically infinite energies and such, and, you know, highly relativistic conditions and such, where time...
That's what I'm saying, Philip, just to stop you for a sec. That's what I'm saying. We have such a center connected into the higher dimensional space of the heart. Like, and I think our reality is holographically projected around a central point.
I quite agree. And perhaps I have to have read a book by Rodney Collins called The Theory of Celestial Influence.
Yes, I've read that.
Okay, great book, which speaks to the law of octaves and the Ennead and the Mipha interval. But one of the things in that book is about the central stillness, or our inability to measure the centers of systems, and I found that very interesting.
Oh, I didn't remember that. I wasn't ready for it at the time. Thanks. I'll have a look back at that.
Yeah, you'll find some very...
One more thing, Philip. I just want to mention one. Have you ever read Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson?
No.
Okay, that's Gurdjieff's writing, and in that book he has a whole different language, but one of the stories he tells Hasin, his grandson, at one point, he says, the three-brain beings on planet Earth used to have their emotional center in the same place that we have it, meaning himself, Beelzebub, and Ahun, and these beings. And he says, and that was in the organ... No, there was an independent brain or organ in the region of the breast, okay, which I would take, he doesn't use the word heart, but I would take that as the heart and the heart center, as you're saying, because I'm saying that the heart isn't simply the physical heart, but that's an aspect of it. And then he says that when human beings became so, they formed these false consciousness systems, then the center of gravity of the emotional center was dispersed from the heart into the complex of nerves of the autonomic nervous system, particularly, he says, the solar plexus. So it's like our heart, in what he's saying in that book, and I think this is a secret in Beelzebub, it's hidden, I think, the heart doctrine in this, what Beelzebub is saying, they as higher beings have this independent brain in the region of the breast, which I would say is the heart and the heart center, but that in mankind asleep, their emotional reactivity is dispersed into the autonomic nervous system, and they no longer have this heart center. So that's just to respond a bit, Philip, to what you're saying about, like, Gurdjieff's teaching, and I think that's a really insightful comment. The other thing about Uspensky and Gurdjieff explain that the attainment of the next level of human consciousness, they call it self-consciousness, and they associate it with the opening of the higher emotional center. And so I would say your heart is the basis for the higher emotional center. But again, I'm not just saying the physical heart, but the heart center, because it's, yeah.
Yes, well, I don't. My standpoint on this was that the word heart was a metaphorical reference to a more appropriately thinking in terms of a center, and in the center of systems. I don't dispute everything you just said. However, I understand, you know, the heart, being that we are a holographic entity, a multi-channel interferometric combination of many different modes, including the heart or the love. So, you know, all of which said I agree with. However, I'm seeking the underlying physics of the universal communication system, information management that's going on And I do believe that seeking, you know, sources of electromagnetic energy in the physical heart is just the wrong way to go. I do believe that consciousness does not, first of all, consciousness, a great metaphor or a great analogy to the problem of consciousness is to speak about a TV. A television acts as our brain in the sense that it mediates communications which are going on, but our consciousness does not live in that TV. The TV programs don't live in that TV.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, and so you see, and you may think of your active conscious thoughts as being the, you know, what's on the screen at any given moment, but that's a holographic output, so to speak, of the interaction going on between the communications, the communication systems inherent in the design, and the modulation of information going in, and it's the whole information. You'll never find a Seinfeld joke inside your television, you know, by dissecting the television.
Yeah.
So this is what's going on with consciousness, and the space, the hard problem of consciousness arises from this holographic nature to it, which is the space in the same way that all holography creates a third dimension, if you will, but depth perception. So that's my take on, it's the brain which is acting as, for example, to use a current technology as a metaphor, is acting like a modem. The brain is uploading and downloading from a...
Well, I argue that all your centers do that. Each of them is an information system. Like the language is different of emotional center and intellectual and moving center.
Right.
But I would see each of them, like, I mean, in the new science, everything in nature, in a way, is a computer. Even elementary particles are seen, they compute the laws of nature.
Yes,
like this is the kind, And everything exists in these information fields. Like, I think one of the most brilliant ideas of Gurdjieff is this idea of the threefoldness of things. And if we apply that to science, we realize that there's not just matter and energy, but there's information or intelligence as third force. And the Gurdjieff just says third force is latent within the medium. So it's latent within the medium of space is this underlying intelligence, fields of intelligence.
Yes.
So we're kind of rooted into those fields of intelligence. You describe it nicely. How did you say it? Interfere, what was your term?
Interferometric.
Yeah, so we respond to these kind of matters, energies, intelligences on different planes of vibrational existence simultaneously.
The seven channels, the seven chakras, or the eight chakras, if you will, or the law of octaves derives from what you said about the 1-3-7 relation. And the three derives from the two. You know, when you holographically combine two channels, you are then creating that third entity, if you will, and that is your three. And from the three to get to the seven, I encourage you to look into set theory and look up the power set, and you will find that the power set is the combinatorial, which a power set is a set of eight elements that you get when you by forming the set of all subsets
of the three, the permutations of the three.
And that's how we get our law of octaves from the 1-3-7.
That's an interesting. Thanks for sharing that.
That's a discovery from my research, which I haven't had a chance to tell you about. But I'll be in touch with you privately, Chris.
I wouldn't agree with what you're saying about the two producing the three. I don't agree with that. Just to mention that,
okay.
Not that I want to go.
Yeah.
Let's throw it over to Jim here. Jim hasn't really had a chance. Thanks, Philip. Stay on the line, Jim.
Sure.
Do you want to add any comments to any of our discussion?
I'm just kind of caught up in it. It's funny the. That Philip mentioned the television analogy because I was just searching for this quote that I had come across from Rupert Sheldrake when he was talking about memory and in the brain. And he says that most people assume that memories are stored inside the brain, and the usual evidence for that is that damage to the brain can result in a loss of memory. this doesn't actually prove anything one way or the other. If you cut out a bit of the circuitry of a TV set, remove the wires and transistors, the pictures on the screen will disappear. Now, that doesn't prove that all the people you see on the screen and the events that are going on there are stored inside the bits that you cut out. It merely proves that you're no longer able to tune them in, which I think is kind of a fundamental mistake that pervades modern research on consciousness, is that people assume that because the brain is associated with all psychological functioning, then that it somehow, you know, it's all stored physically in the brain and produced by the brain's electrochemical processes. But there's another explanation, one which is makes a whole different set of assumptions about everything in terms of matter and energy and information.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Why I like that metaphor, that analogy. And it could be used to explain even more if we are looking for a quantum mechanical explanation of consciousness and how the universe is synthesizing the overall hologram that we're all sort of entangled with and sensing and feeling the space of, so to speak. We can now look to the brain for how it's managing information to what can be the parallel between the brain's handling of photons of light and sounds and such, that it is, one might say, accelerating information beyond the physical constants of space-time itself, you know, because consciousness is something which is non-local to space-time.
Well, I would particularly put that dynamic, I would say it's centered in the heart rather than the brain. I mean, it's like... on my site, I do a review of the Scientific American article, Are You a Hologram? And they show a person's head with a kind of a sphere around a person's head, thinking that it's only the mind that's entangled with the universe. Whereas I'm saying what we really need to do is take the whole human being as a quantum system, and the heart is the center of the human being as a living quantum system. And even in the birth of as a fetus is conceived, in a way, the heart forms first. So even in terms of embryology, or I've not got a term.
Let me agree with you by saying that my point is that heart, that center, is superconductively linked with all the other hearts and all the other centers of all the other systems of all the other everything in space-time. This is the sense in which we...
Well, that's what I agree with. And I'm saying that interconnectedness is ultimately most based on the heart dynamics. Like in the Upanishads, at one point it says, the Upanishads of ancient India says, the earth, the moon, the sun, the stars, all the things in the outer world are within the cave of Brahman, or the lotus of the heart. So what the mystics are saying is it's within the heart that we have this deepest level of our interconnectedness to the universe, and that the heart is that center of the system that, Philip, you were mentioning.
Yeah.
And how we can't understand, as we try to understand the center of something and we take it down to zero point levels, it's like it passes into the infinite.
That's right.
I'm saying that we each are rooted into the infinite through the zero-point dynamics underlying the heart. And I did just two other things, Philip, like your background physics, that I say about the physics of the heart. One is, I'm saying, first, I think there's a concept of there being a divine source emanation, which is brought down to the spiritual spark. And in the heart, it's related to what's described as the bliss sheath, the mass of unemergent light, okay, which is the size of a small grape. So I'm imagining, what would that mean in terms of physics? So this a mass of unemergent light, see, that could be the basis, firstly, for the holographic projection of human experience, because there's an inner light source. Like in modern views of holography and psychology, no one thinks there's an inner light source.
My apologies. I was simply going to say, you remind me in that statement that I wanted to remind you that holography is not exclusive to, you know, the light. Interferometry is the phased intermixing of information streams you know, pardon me, it's the proper commingling of information in phase so as to interferometry. So it's not we're not just looking for light, and light is
also... No, I agree. All things, I mean, holography is a function of wave properties, and all things have wave and material aspect to them simultaneously.
Exactly.
So, it's, as you say, it's not just light. But I am saying that I say a human being has this jiva atma, this point, this source of supernal light. So I'm saying that's an actual model. I'm not saying I can prove it's right, but I'm saying that is what seems to me is proposed in mystical teachings. And the other idea that I think is really important in trying to understand the physics of the heart is this idea I mentioned from my Kabbalistic studies, which is the concept of what's called the zimzum. And the idea is that we imagine the ground zero-point field at some level having infinite energy in it.
It does.
And that when creation of an individual or finite being occurs, there has to be a withdrawal of the infinite around a central point that creates a vacated space. See, if there wasn't a space that is in some way vacated, well, then everything would be swallowed up in the infinite. So the existence of a finite system involves, at some level, there's a vacated space. And in mystical teachings, we all have that vacated space within the heart. And it's a way of trying to understand human psychology, of how we try to fill something in the heart. It's like the heart's desires. And what are those? In a way, we try to fulfill our heart's desires or to fulfill that emptiness. So I think in a very essential way, there's a physics to the nothingness underlying the heart. And that to understand consciousness, just as we need to understand the idea of consciousness related to light, it's also we need to try to understand consciousness and its relationship to space. Because in the world around us, everything we see as objects exists within space, but space itself is invisible. We can't see it. It has no color. We can't taste it. We can't smell it. Space is in a way a form of no-thingness, but it's because of that space or no-thingness that things can then exist. So space is like this no-thingness which allows for the presence of things. So I think consciousness is like that in a way. It's a form of no-thingness. Yes. And it's because of that no-thingness, then, that we can be aware of anything in the matrix of creation established surrounding that central vacated space.
Yes.
I don't know it yet.
I agree. Like, we are activating the reality. It is we who, in a sense, are activating our consensus reality by our interaction with this, you know, infinitely malleable matrix, you know, and it is our participation, it is our interaction with the overall system that, yes, we're carving out a space, if you like, but space, spatiality, the dimensions left, right, up, down, so, you know, back, forth, and such, the degrees of freedom, the channels of interaction that we have, the sub-channels of interaction that we have with the overall energy matrix of the universe. And to be sure, consciousness has a special role in the sense that it's information management on a very high level. Our spirit nature is information management and cosmological memory. You know, our soul and such, and our knowledge, and as you were saying before, is not in our brain. It's stored in the fabric of the universe itself. And
yes.
And that is a conscious bandwidth. That is a self-aware bandwidth, and that is a creative bandwidth. And we all have sub-channels and, so to speak, user accounts within that bandwidth. A quantum mechanical principle comes into play here. We are at once distinct within that bandwidth, but we are simultaneously having the opposite property of being indistinguishable from the rest of that bandwidth.
Yeah. It's a neat phrase in the Vedas. I don't know the Indian expression of it, but it reads simultaneously one and different.
Yes. And
that's, in a way, that's where simultaneously individualized and all one.
Yes.
Like at one level, it's seemingly individualized, but at another level, that individuation dissolves into the unity.
Yes, taking a higher sort of level definition. You know, it's how you ask the question and how you view the situation. But this principle of seeming opposites being simultaneously in play is a quantum mechanical principle embodied in the superposition principle, and it's keyed right into quantum mechanics. And this is why quantum mechanics is the physics you should be seeking to use to unlock your model, because I believe, anyway, rather than string theory in Calabi-Yau spaces, because string theory is in doubt for a variety of reasons, but one of which is that there's no obvious fundamental strings in nature as a fundamental entity to which to base a theory on, you know, Einsteinian principle that your theory should have a corresponding element in nature, but that side. But quantum mechanics is in no doubt. And just this principle alone of the superposition principle and the entanglement phenomenon and so on and so forth points, you know, great probable cause for this being our underlying physics to explain all these things. And I think...
Well, I would say one thing, like in the new holographic physics, to explain how I see it, I think, like you say, you don't think I should use the model of the, like, seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces.
No, I don't think so.
But in a way, the way I see it, you know, in the new holographic model, you have higher-dimensional or anti-de-Sitler spaces.
Right.
And the physics in higher-dimensional anti-de-Sitler spaces, the physics of that in string theories in higher dimensional de Sitler spaces are equivalent to the quantum mechanical theory on the outer in the ordinary space-time complex. So there's a similarity. There's an equivalency of the physics that the perturbations of this element in hyperspace. Those perturbations or movement or activities of this monad in hyperspace, I would call it, that produces the materializations of bodies and the quantum physical nature surrounding the central point, and that there's an equivalency of physics. On one level, what appears as quantum mechanical in the higher-dimensional anti-de-Sitler space, or what I would call hyperspace, that could all correspond to the physics of a monadic Calabi-Yau space in seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau space. So that's how I'm kind of seeing it, Phil. I'm not saying that I know that's true, obviously, but that's how I'm trying to understand it.
In as much as string theory is mathematics, it is correct from that standpoint, because mathematics is a kind of formal system which decodes nature, but our problem is interpretation usually. But to the extent that superstring is based on mathematics, it is in some sense correct. It may be equivalent, but it may be more complicated way of viewing, the same thing seen in some other way, in some other fashion. So that's why I'm saying quantum. I think we will find what we need in quantum mechanics, but it doesn't rule out that framework of superstring and Calabi-Yau spaces and those interpretations might very well be equivalent or sufficiently so to be true statements to use them that way. But
just to stay with the notion of quantum theory, that I remember one thing I think that's really interesting is how Gurdjieff explains that the law of seven really has to do with the quantized nature of reality, that reality, levels of reality are not as on the continuous scale, but actually there's discrete levels that are quantized. So Gurdjieff at one point explains that the law of seven, the notion of that corresponds, what he's really saying in modern terms is that nature is quantized. There are discrete vibrational levels.
Yeah. And I think I was just going to say, remember to look up power set.
Power set.
Power set. Because that is, to me, that's when I saw that it all came together regarding the 137 issues and the law of octaves and how we get our wave mechanics, or the mathematics of our wave mechanics. And we even get our fractal nature because you recall that, of course, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. You have the do repeating into the next octave, and that is the power set also has a subset, which is the set of all members of the set, which is a little fractal image of the main set, you know. And so we recover a lot of holographic principles, nonlinear dynamics, fractalization, self-similarity at all scales in our material, in the material. And from theory of celestial influence, Ronnie Collins' book, and the law of octaves, there's this whole analysis of the mi-fa intervals and how our, for example, our biosphere and the habitable zone around the sun and how a galaxy, how these are special locations which are the interaction spaces formed by the combination of opposites, the pure generic holographic principle right there, stated right there, where you have the simple interaction of any two conceptually linked opposites. This is your generic hologram. And it's you know, we have wave-particle duality. We have all these combined opposites everywhere we look, and that's because these things are little holograms. These things are little interferometric entities, and which interact wave mechanically. And the rules of interaction are this is where you get your resonance principles, and how there is a certain enhanced degree of receptivity between similar systems because they have more, similar channels, similar
resonances.
Exactly.
Great. I'm afraid that I lost aspects of it. I'm thanks for calling in, Philip. I want to kind of wind up a bit, and I don't know if there's any other caller. We'll kind of take the line back here. Philip, do contact me. Thanks for calling.
My pleasure.
Feel free to call in again, and I'd like to talk to you more.
Great work, too. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay, Don, if anybody else calls through, you can put them through to us. We'll try to open it up for a few minutes. Jim, any kind of comment? Or?
Well, we don't get a lot of calls, but we sure get good ones.
yeah, that was really interesting.
That was amazing.
I didn't gasp at all.
Neither did I, but it's very interesting to hear somebody with a background in physics and familiarity with Rodney Collin and your
Gurdjieff
work and Gurdjieff and explaining things in such interesting terms, you know. I have a question actually that maybe Philip can call back and address this the next time we're on. I'd be very interested to hear how, in terms of Gurdjieff, he talks about the precession of an octave depends on shocks and the fulfillment of shocks, otherwise the octave will not be completed. And I'd be interested in his interpretation of how he understands the idea of shocks in octaves in physics and in nature. And I think that's something that's really missing in the scientific view of things. That I don't see that in a way. He started to address it. Actually, he started to talk a little bit about it. But it would be very interesting to return to that topic.
Maybe Philip will call back in 2 weeks again.
Yeah.
I didn't know we have someone else on the line there. Oh, okay, I guess not. Sorry, Jim, I kind of cut you off. I thought there might be someone there.
That's okay. I came across something the other day I was reading about Emanuel Swedenborg, who was a 17th century Swedish scientist and mystic who had all these visions and spoke to angels and wrote several volumes of interpretation of the scriptures based on his knowledge of the spirit world and was truly a Renaissance man. But he wrote a book called The Principia in 1734. And he talked about, he says that, I thought of your work in terms of zero points. He said, it says, Swedenborg perceived clearly that for anything to exist, it must be continually being created from within itself. Since for Swedenborg, space, time, and matter originate from the infinite, which is spaceless, timeless, and matterless, their origin is viewed at their own physical level can only be a dimensionless point, which is not limited in its location, but is universally present everywhere. He calls
That's from Swedenborg's.
Yeah, he
principle.
calls it the natural point. It's the physical
natural point.
Yeah, the physical world's nexus with the infinite. Every point must contain in itself infinite energy.
That's beautiful. What a nice quote. I hope you can send me that. It's one of those quotes that so illustrates the whole zero point, like the zero point teaching, the zero point is where the finite kind of resolves back into the infinite. And those points at which that happen have special, non-easily discernible properties. So it's like as something's narrowed to a point, the finite passes into the infinite. So that point of transition is like the zero point. That is through the zero point that the infinite comes down into inform the finite, or the finite can resolve back into the infinite. So I'm saying that's the concept of the zero point transitional sentence. That's a beautiful quote from Swedenborg.
Yeah, wow. very interesting. And it goes on in terms of how he describes, like, you know, the actual physics of this. But I was quite stunned when I read it because I thought, wow, you know, like that's quite amazing.
You
I
know,
mean, that's a really interesting thing about your work that I was just going to say is how, you know, these zero points, it's the same dynamic which accounts for everything in creation. Like, it exists on an individual level in terms of consciousness, but you're also saying, like, the creation of worlds is dependent upon this. I just think it's such a fascinating concept, you know. Then, in that respect, then you understand how, you know, man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, how as above, so below, these ancient esoteric aphorisms, you begin to realize that they contain this incredible knowledge in them, that they're not just kind of little sayings, but they actually, in a few words, capture kind of the essence of reality. It's quite amazing, you know. In those terms, you know. God,
I mean, as you say, the idea, like, yeah, the individual human being having a zero-point singularity center and how the universe emerged from such a singularity zero-point center. So that's a perfect analogy, the microcosm to the macrocosm. And it's all to do with this higher-dimensional physics. So it's not that a man in the physical body looks like the universe, but more in the kind of physics of inner physics of creation.
Yeah, point source of light. It's like man is created in God's image, and as like Gurdjieff says in Beelzebub's Tales, it's not because they both carry their combs in their breast pockets. that there are some higher dimensional principles applicable at both levels. You know, it's so funny, like how when you read people criticizing mystical ideas, how they interpret it in the most fundamental, you know, ways, and you know, take everything literally and have no kind of idea of the incredible, you know, thought that's behind this, and the incredible model of consciousness and the understanding of creation that underlies these ideas. And yet people will respond, like people talk about being one with the universe, and they think that, you know, they understand what this means, and then they sort of dismiss it, you know. But I mean, it's such a profound idea when you actually understand what's involved, or have an inkling of what's involved. I mean, not that I understand.
And then now we see modern physics gives us like a conceptual theoretical foundation in which to understand the possibility of that.
Yeah, exactly.
It does.
Exactly.
Like modern
absolutely.
Quantum theory regards any elements that leave a singlet state as remain entangled in higher dimensional phase space. And the whole universe emerged from a single point. So that implies in quantum theory itself the ultimate interconnectedness of the whole of creation. So this idea of the mystics of this kind of essential unity underlying creation is now totally consistent with this whole framework of quantum theory, is the interconnectedness of all things. Like, that's what David Bohm arrived at, and is the colleague of Einstein's, in his model of wholeness and the implicate order. He says the fundamental reality, we have to understand, the fundamental reality is one of undivided wholeness and unity of creation. And then the apparent, the illusion, or the Maya, is the apparent differentiation into all separateness.
Yeah.
Okay, so something is breaking in a little bit here. Is that Don? Jim?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah. I was getting a bit of interference.
Yeah.
Well, we've just got a few minutes. Any final thanks? What a neat quote from Swedenborg. Wow, I like that. I've been meaning to read some Leibniz lately, because he's the one who kind of developed monadology, and partly Blavatsky drew from Leibniz, and Leibniz developed calculus, which all has to do with, you know, how things, as they approach infinity and such, you know, derivations from, okay, so Jim, any kind of final thing that you can think of that you wanted to come back
to? Well, I was just going to say that I think today we've kind of, you know, if people are just listening for the first time, we kind of bounced around today a little bit and touched on a variety of things. But that as you said at the beginning, I think, you know, what you're presenting here and what we're trying to develop and communicate to people is a completely different way of understanding the most basic aspects of who we are and the nature of creation, and it takes a while, and you have to kind of listen and think about it and try to observe things, and so, you know, you have to kind of stick with it a little bit to really grasp what we're getting at here. But you know, I think if you do, it's worth the trip, and it's quite a trip. I mean, it's incredibly exciting, incredibly interesting, I think. And you know, boy, if there are more people out there who want to call, like Philip, that's a hard act to follow. But that was
yeah, it's a pleasure.
That was very fascinating to hear him today. So it was very interesting.
I hope sometime you'll listen into Coast to Coast. I understand Coast to Coast, my show from last week, I think they have free stream link today. I think you can go back. They have 1 or 2 days free, so you may be able to zip in there and listen to my show. You're not signed up to stream link.
No.
Anyway, I'd like to thank readers. I'm going to take a couple minutes. I'll come back to you before we end, Jim, but just remind listeners, www.zeropoint.ca. I have some excellent books here, which are really only available through my website unless you attend some of my public talks. I have a lot of new materials up there. I'm trying to do a critique of what I call new think, this fundamentally kind of mistaken false teaching that's kind of emerged in the mainstream of science, and I see it almost as a dogma, and I think those of us of a religious, spiritual, or mystical persuasion, we need to rise to the challenge to understand those traditions in the light of modern science. Mysticism has nothing to fear from science. Science will help illuminate what the myth is. Science can help us understand the esoteric teachings. Especially, you just see that now, the whole modern concept of singularities, of vacuum genesis, all these new ideas of holography, all these new ideas emerging in science begin to give us the framework to understand what the mystics have been teaching for thousands of years. So mysticism has nothing to fear from science. It's the pseudo-materialistic science, silly science philosophy of the head doctrine and random happenstance, evolution by happenstance. Those, I would say, have a lot to fear from people attaining a deeper self-knowledge and an understanding of the secret. So I'm saying the deeper secret is to explore the deeper nature of self connected to the mysteries of the human heart, and that's wherein the secrets lie. And when people came to Gibran the prophet, they said, speak to us of self-knowledge. And he says, your heart knows in silence the secrets of the days and nights. Your mind longs to for the knowledge and wisdom of the heart. So that, I would say, is the real secret. It's not just your wish fulfillment, acquiring all the material things you want and positions and power in life. When we live in such a world of kind of criminality, and I'm encouraging listeners also, let's wake up, let's wake up. We have to have this transformation of human consciousness that we turn back and try to cope with some of the madness. Okay, so that was another show. This is Zero Point Radio. I'm Christopher Holmes. Thank you, James Moffat.
Yeah,
and thank you, Philip, for calling in. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, and struggle to remember yourself. Learn to live in the heart. Thank you. Goodbye.